Just after 2 minutes past eight, and time now here on RTE Radio 1 for The Book Show.
Welcome to The Book Show with me, Sinead Gleeson. Get in touch by email, bookshow@rte.ie, or find us on Twitter and Facebook at bookshowrte. On the show this evening, writer Juno Diaz on his latest book, This Is How You Lose Her, and his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. Later in the show, we pay a visit to the Ballymun Book Exchange, but first, it was hard to argue with the fact that 2013 was a great year for Irish literature. There were lots of literary debuts, including Donal Ryan and Eimear McBride, and I caught up with both writers to talk about Donal's book, The Spinning Heart, which won the Guardian First Book Award, and Eimear McBride, whose novel, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, which won the Goldsmith Prize for Literature. Now, before Christmas, we heard on this show about how Donal's book was picked from the slush pile after 2.5 years of being rejected. It went on to become an Irish publishing story of the year, but Eimear McBride's tale of being turned down was even longer.
I did. I spent 9 years trying to get it published. So I know the story of the slush pile very well.
And in terms of when you were both in the midst of this and sending out the emails and sending out the manuscripts and trekking off to the post office or the email outbox, how do you not get discouraged and how do you keep persisting? And is there a moment where you almost give up, maybe?
Well, I certainly did get discouraged. I reached a point about 5 years in where I thought, well, this book isn't going to get published, and the best I can hope for is that I'll write my second one and maybe there'll be interest off that. And so by the time I actually did have interest in A Girl, I was very surprised.
And did you think that because your book is very different, and this has been pointed out by a lot of people in terms of the language and the way it's presented to a lot of other of its contemporaries, do you think publishers were fearful of taking on a book like yours?
Yeah, absolutely. And they were quite honest about that. I mean, most of them wrote glowing rejection letters saying, oh, we think it's wonderful and the writing is fantastic, but we can't market it, or we don't think we can sell it, and we won't take the risk on it. Which was very dispiriting.
What was it about your book, for anybody who hasn't yet read it, that maybe publishers would have been fearful of?
I think it's the language. When you look at it on the page, it looks quite different. It's quite chopped up. There isn't a lot of punctuation apart from the full stop. And I think it seems quite intimidating until you read it and read a few pages of it, and then that kind of falls away a bit more.
And we'll just take it, to give people a sense of your book, I think, Eimear, we'll just hear a section from A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing.
Her heart going pat, going dum dum dum. Don't mind me, she's going to your room. See the Jesus, what have they done? Jesus, bile for, titles burn. Shh, all over mother, she cries, oh no, oh no, no, no. I know the thing wrong, it is called. Nosebleeds, headaches, where you can't hold. Full mugs and dinner plates, she says, clear up. Ah, young, he says, give the child a break. Fall off swings, cantor, grip well. Slipping in the muck, bang your poor head, wrapped up white and the blood come through. She feel the sick of that, little boy head. Shh.
And that was Eimear McBride reading from A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. Did either of you have any fear in terms of your subject matter, whether that's, you know, modern Irish life or the church or drinking or poverty or things, maybe things that we've seen in Irish novels before? Did you think, I don't want to go down that road again? It's been tackled before. And did you have any sort of self-censorship, if you like?
Yeah, there were certain kind of Irish literary tropes that I decided to stay away from, you know. But then you'll almost always come back into these things again because they're so ubiquitous, you know, all the usual things. Because it's life, it's Irish life. I kind of decided early on I'd write the book as though nobody would ever read it, because I was pretty much convinced at the time anyway that would be the case. And, you know, so I was able to divest myself fairly easily of kind of fear of censure or people going, oh, yawn, this is the same old crap again, you know. But I said I'll speak in as true a voice as possible for me, and everyone's different, so if I sound like somebody else, you know, I think all literature will be a little bit derivative in a way. But I have to say, accept Eimear, really, because, and I have to say, I'm very glad that Eimear's book exists, because I think now there's a kind of stylistic benchmark for literature in Ireland, and England as well, I'd say, that's, I think, will be unassailable for a good while, so we can all settle down now and realise this is the height of it, really, linguistically.
Well, that's great news. Well, you know, I think for me, I was very concerned about, you know, sort of falling into a story about sexual abuse and, you know, the church and religious country life. And but at the same time, as Donald says, those are the stories that we live amongst and grew up with and are part of us. And those stories still need to be told and still need to be examined. And I think the important thing for writers is trying to find new ways to tell those stories and slightly different angles to view them from.
For a long time, I think there was a shorthand for what an Irish writer was. You know, we think about some of those themes that you talk about, or setting or place or rural life, and all of those things like deprivation. Do you think of yourself as an Irish writer, whatever that might be?
Yeah, I do. I see myself as part of the modernist tradition, really. Sort of much further on and somewhat changed, but I certainly see myself as part of that. And I think also the fact that I don't live in Ireland at the moment, I kind of feel part of that, the Irish diaspora tradition as well.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same. And I know whenever I'm reviewed, John McGahern is mentioned, and, you know, he's a huge hero of mine, and he was a big name in my house growing up, and it's great. And, you know, I'd like to see myself as being in the avant-garde, but I suppose I have to admit that I'm not, really.
I spoke a couple of years ago to DBC Pierre, who had massive success with the first book, and he said he had a lot of regrets with hitting it big with a first book, and both of your books, first books, have been very successful. Is that in any way kind of daunting, in that you feel that there's pressure on you to maintain a certain standard, to always get better? Or I'm sure you maybe wouldn't have liked to have to graft for three books and then get the success. Are there pitfalls?
I actually often think of Vernon God Little when I'm thinking about Spinning Heart and how it was received so well, and how, you know, it did make a far bigger splash than I ever thought it would. And Vernon God Little, I think, is one of the best books I've ever read. It's just fantastic. Yeah, and I sometimes think, is this it for me? You know, have I got two novels in me and that's it? You know, even though I have kind of two half-formed manuscripts at home, but it is definitely a worry, all right, yeah. Even though it shouldn't be. And I tend to always focus on the negative, of course.
I think it is definitely a pressure. I found it originally when the book started to be reviewed. A lot of the reviewers sort of said, oh, can she write another one like this? And this is so unusual. And I did get the fear a bit at that point. But as the months have gone on, I've kind of returned to the position I was in, really, when I felt that I was going to spend my life as a sort of failed unpublished writer, which was, well, this is what I'm going to do and I can't do anything better. So even if I'm never published, I'm just going to keep working, and I'm sort of trying to return to that spirit again.
So we've heard some of Emer McBride's book. We might hear some of your book, Donal. You're going to read a section from The Thing About December. Maybe you'd tell us a bit about the part you're going to read.
This is just the main character, Johnsy, kind of ruminating to himself on his own weakness. And Johnsy has a very kind of facile, one-dimensional image in his head of what constitutes being tough and being strong. And he thinks back to his antecedents who fought in the War of Independence and to these kind of apocryphal tales he's been told as a child. And this is what he thinks is being strong. And he compares himself all the time to people who are just ghosts, really. Johnsy liked thinking about the stories Daddy used to tell him before he went to sleep. A rake of his great uncles were priests in Scotland and America and Canada. They joined the priesthood and exiled themselves as penance for taking the lives of so many black and tans years ago during the War of Independence. Daddy's father was only very young, the youngest of six boys and a girl, and he and his sister would be warming blocks all night and placing them in the lads' empty beds, down low where their feet would be if they were not patrolling the countryside, shooting Englishmen. So when they came home and tore their clothes off and jumped into their beds, their feet would warm quick enough, so that if they were raided, their mother would shout, "Sure look, sir, feel those boys' feet. They've been in their beds since sunset, for they've all to be up at cockcrow." And sure enough, the rotten bastard would beat them from their beds with the butt of his dirty English gun and line them up for his inspection, and they'd act like they'd just been dragged from the deepest of sleep and their toes toasty, and that trick saved many a young rebel's life.
And that was Donal Ryan reading from The Thing About December. Donal, you're still working away full-time as well. Do you think you're going to have to make a decision at some point about whether it's a writer's life for you?
Well, the decision is made for me by money, really. I mean, there isn't enough money in this game at the moment to pay the mortgage. So if I left, my job would be out in the street. So, you know, for the time being, it's fine because I love my job. It's very absorbing, you know, and I'm still in my 9 p.m. to midnight writing slots, so it's fine.
Emer, did you get a sense when you had that, that those long 9 years and you were working away and trying to get to a place where the book would be out in the world, where you thought, I'm going to go off and do something different, I'm not going to do this, this writing's not for me?
I never thought writing wasn't for me, but I certainly did think, oh, maybe I should really be doing something else, something a bit more productive. But then I realised there wasn't really anything else I was equipped to do, so that made the decision for me.
And that was two of the biggest Irish publishing success stories of last year. Emer McBride's A Girl is a Half-Form Thing is published by Galley Beggars Press, and Donal Ryan's latest book, The Thing About December, is published by Doubleday Ireland and Lilliput Press. So, are you sick of looking at the books on your shelves that you've already read, or just want to get your hands on a few new titles? You could do worse than head down to the Book Exchange in the Ballymun Civic Centre in North Dublin. Zoe Cummins went along to swap a couple of her books for some new ones.
Today, in the concourse of the Ballymun Civic Centre, are about 15 tables stacked with a couple of thousand books for the monthly book exchange.
People can come and choose a book to read, and they can bring a book and they can exchange a book every month.
Susan Walsh, Education Programme Manager at the Ballymun Whitehall Area Partnership, shows me around.
Easily a couple of thousand, and again, they would range from everything from novels to biographies, history. We would have a very, very diverse range of books here. So something for everybody.
Well, my name's Audrey Keogh, the Book Exchange Development Officer. I wasn't great actually until I started working here, but you find yourself then every month picking up two or three books. So.
And what's the book that you've read in the last year that is really you really enjoyed?
We had a local writer who's from Whitehall, Patrick Ryan. He came to the Book Exchange, and his book is... It's about the drugs crisis in Dublin. He was on drugs himself. He talks about the drugs crisis in the inner city. And it was just, I suppose, gave me an insight to something that I never would have been aware of or would have had any idea about before.
What do you think is valuable about reading?
The confidence I find, especially with book exchanges that come through here. We'd get a lot of passerbys every month. Some people come and they'll ask what it's about, and they'll say they're not a great reader, and you find they'll pick up a book and they'll come back the next month and tell you, oh, it was brilliant, and they've gotten through it. So I think giving people back that confidence that they probably never would have had before in reading and writing. And this is, I suppose, the aim of the Book Exchange as well.
So I brought along a few kids' books.
Oh, great, yeah.
Look, kids' books we always are delighted to get, because we do really encourage that children themselves are encouraged to read and have access to books. So we're delighted to get stuff like this.
So I brought along The Gruffalo, which is very popular.
Yeah, that's right.
I haven't read this one. This is The Harbinger by Jonathan Cahn, but I thought it's in very good nick. And
it is in
it's
perfect
one
condition.
That I'm not madly interested in 9/11 conspiracies, so I thought maybe I might find something else I prefer. Yeah.
Well, there'll definitely be somebody here who would like to read that.
Yeah, and this is by Elizabeth Gilbert.
Oh, very good, yeah, very good. And again, we would have had a few of her Eat, Pray, Loves, because again, there would have been that time when it was a really, really popular novel to read. So this will be good for somebody then to be able to read if they like her.
Maybe if we could put this on the table on
that. Yeah, great.
I'll have a little look around and see if I can find anything I like instead.
Yeah, definitely.
You've just dropped in a few books?
I have, yes. I've brought in about 12.
Have you read them all?
I've read them all, yeah. I come here every month and get a collection of books. I was never much of a reader, but once the book club started, I really took it up. And it's a great selection, I have to say, yeah.
I would read anything bar romance. I hate romantic books, yeah, yeah. Not that I have that much romance in my life, but I hate romantic books, I do, yeah. Well, I can tolerate a little bit, but not too much.
I'd like history books and biographies. That's kind of my end of it. So you're learning all the time, expanding your knowledge.
I don't mind autobiographies on people who've actually lived. But you know these 20-year-olds and they have their autobiographies?
Yeah,
they drive me mad. They haven't lived. Yeah. Don't mind someone like Nelson Mandela. Wonderful life, but some little Justin Bieber or one of them little guys, you know.
Yeah.
They irritate me.
Wayne Rooney, he's written two.
Oh, yeah.
There's two episodes
Silly
of his life
boy,
already.
Yeah.
Susan. I'm finding it very difficult to decide.
It's
what
really
I'm going
difficult,
to get.
Isn't it? Yeah, because there is such a range. Like, you know, you have so many different authors, you know, in so many different fields.
I had about 10 books in my hand a few minutes ago. I've managed to whittle it down to 5. And before I leave, I'm going to get rid of another 2 because I know I won't read them this month.
I know, this is it. This is it. And I think that's the whole idea is, look, take some books. Hopefully you'll read them. And then if you can get them back to us, that's great. But it is the idea that, look, anybody can come in here, get some books, off they go, and enjoy reading, which is great.
They're yours now.
Oh, that's
there
great.
There we go.
So I'm happy now. I've got my books all swapped and everything. Thanks a million. Take care now. Bye.
Enjoy the books.
And that was Zoe Cummins there at the Ballymun Book Exchange. It's a monthly event, and you can check out their Facebook page or email bookexchange@ballymun.org for details. Now, Junot Diaz won the Pulitzer Prize for The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao in 2008. His latest short story collection, This Is How You Lose Her, was a bestseller and National Book Award finalist in 2013. We met up with him in Housing Works, a thriving and extremely busy New York bookshop where all proceeds go to the homeless in the city. I started by asking Diaz about his Dominican background and the influence that this has had on his work.
Well, I mean, one must understand that I'm a member of a diaspora with very powerful circuits in New Jersey and New York. So part of what we're talking about is that when I left the sort of geographical Dominican Republic, I was still living inside of the sort of cultural national Dominican Republic. I grew up inside of a very strong, hyper-nationalist charged community space. In some ways, those members of the diaspora kept alive and certainly kept in circulation things about the Dominican Republic and about being Dominican that weren't always as explicit even back home. So I think it's more that it's my immigration doesn't begin to describe how continuous my life vis-a-vis the Dominican Republic has been, simply because I'm a member of this kind of wild group of a million people leaving the island at roughly the same time.
When you started writing the Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, did you in any way intend, apart from the story of the boy and a coming-of-age story, and he's a very unusual boy, did you intend all the political stuff to be in there, or did it just filter itself in and force its way into your story?
Well, no, I mean, I think that this is going to be a novel about dictatorship. I knew right away that I was writing a book that would pivot around a very private, intimate question of one young man's sort of intimate life. But it would pivot equally around a family's plight in the face of a dangerous, toxic, overwhelmingly oppressive dictatorship. So there was no way that this stuff wasn't going to be in there. I think that the kind of strategy I took with it was having this rather aggressively irreverent narrator who rendered what we would call the political content and the historical content of the novel, rendered it in a way that was rather unusual. I mean, talk about someone who has very, almost no respect for the formality of political and historical discourse. So I wanted it in there, but I wanted it in there in a way that would be almost unrecognizable to people.
Junior, you're going to read a bit from the book for us. Could you tell us a bit about what you're going to read?
This is from my latest book, This Is How You Lose Her, the final chapter, which is called The Cheater's Guide to Love. And in it, a young Dominican man growing up in Jersey more or less incinerates the relationship of his life with the love of his life, and this is his attempting to recover from it, and sort of a document of a 5-year spiral of post-relationship heartbreak, mourning, and self-loathing. So this is at the end of the 5 years, when he's been through everything and tried everything to avoid his own responsibility in what has happened, because in the end, he's the one who destroyed the relationship. Some nights you have neuromancer dreams where you see the ex and the boy and another figure, familiar, waving at you in the distance, somewhere very close, the laugh that wasn't laughter. And finally, when you feel like you can do so without blowing into burning atoms, you open up a folder you have hidden under your bed. The Doomsday Book. Copies of all the emails and the photos from the cheating days. The ones that the ex found and compiled and mailed to you a month after she ended it. Dear Junior, for your next book. Probably the last time she wrote your name. She read the whole thing cover to cover. Yes, she put covers on it. You are surprised at what a chicken shit coward you are. It kills you to admit it, but it is true. You are astounded by the depths of your mendacity. When you finish the book a second time, you say the truth. You did the right thing, Negra. You did the right thing.
Junior also features in that book, and he features in a lot of your work. Why are you so compelled to keep going back to him and letting him tell your stories?
Well, because I just think that he's a useful set of narrative strategies for me. He's a particularly productive lens through which to view the world. And you do enough work on a character, you sort of limb them with enough signification and enough backstory. They're good for a couple books. I feel like Junior, I had created a character that I had a sense that he was going to keep giving for a little while past, you know, his expiration date. And part of it is that he's fascinated and fascinating in the themes that I'm interested in. So that when it comes to issues of masculinity, which it comes to the issues of intimacy, when it comes to the issue of sort of what does it mean to be alive in a sort of a wildly racialized, wildly sort of overdetermined power structural society. He just seems like someone who's so fantastically, acutely honest and perceptive that it just kind of seemed like a perfect foil for a world that doesn't seem to be bending over itself to talk about a lot of the things he wants to talk about. And he just is productive. Eventually, probably already, I will stop writing about him.
Is Oscar in some way your attempt to represent a different idea of the Dominican male? Because there's a lot of talk of machismo and that sort of the hardworking family man or the serial cheater. Oscar represents something else, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't narrow it down to Dominican males. I would say very specifically the joke about this book is that no more than Melville imagined that what he was writing only applies to whalers. The fact that I'm writing about Dominicans is only there to expand the argument that this is an issue of masculinity. I've yet to encounter a country where any of the sort of broad accusations that Dominican men or other people level towards Dominican men isn't in currency. Yeah. So males who cheat and who are over invested in certain forms of retrogressive masculinity. Gee, where the hell can I find that? That would be everywhere. And any of us guys who grew up with these sort of muscular, toxic regimes know that I think a lot of us have intimate knowledge of what it means to be a person or to know a person who doesn't either ascribe to those regimes or are the losers inside of those hierarchical patterns. And I guess I thought, what better way to talk about this kind of masculinity than to write a book that's centered on its absolute obverse?
I read somewhere that you said that most of your readers are women. How do your female readers respond to the men in the book and the women in the book and how they're represented? Do you think they, like, take a character like Junior, for example, who is very problematic in lots of ways in terms of the way he treats women and the way he disregards them. Do people ever call you on that and ask you about why he does the things that he does?
I mean, I don't know. I guess my question would be, so what is the relationship of the writer? Like, I guess I'm not here to console anybody. In other words, I'm not matchmaking. I'm not asking people to date Junior. You know, I doubt anyone
Imagine.
Calls up. I could help, but I mean, but no, I'm just saying, like, anybody calls up a writer and says, well, you know, Humbert in Lolita is a terrible character. Why have you imposed this on us? I mean, I guess my sense of this tends to be a sense that Who has more experience with characters like Junior, women or men? Who is sort of more intimate of what it means to wrestle with, to attempt to integrate, to attempt to renounce these types of masculinities and those who embody them? I mean, I don't think boys see boys the way a reader is presented with Junior. I don't think that's the case at all. I think when boys think of themselves, and generally, I'm assuming they're thinking of themselves the way the guys I grew up are thinking of themselves, as particularly heroic, blameless, and awesome. But this is a book with, I would argue, a rather critical perspective. And so a reader, instead of receiving the ambassador of a male, is receiving what I would argue is a much more accurate map of a masculinity. And so for me, the question isn't that who the hell would want to date Junior. The question is, why does everybody date Junior? Why is everybody related to men like this? What is it about our lives, and what is it about the sort of systems that we're in, where these guys not only have space, but have enormous amount of success? And what are the costs to everyone of these kind of rabid masculinities? And so, I mean, of course, people could be like to me, oh, well, you wrote such a sexist character. And I'm like, well, wait a minute.
But is your sexist character a way of exploring those problems and those issues? That's what it comes across to me, that you're trying to look at those problems by giving us this character.
Well, I mean, I would argue the same. But again, it's the grad students will decide this issue. I firmly believe that the grad students will absolve me, you know.
It seems to me as well that you're going to go off in a very different direction. If Monstro, the extract from forthcoming work, is anything to go by, are you interested in science fiction and dystopia, that kind of work?
Sure. I mean, gee whiz, being a person of color in the society like ours, you're already a genre and you're already science fiction to the larger world. And for many people, you're also horror, you know. I guess I've always been interested in since I was a kid. But for me, again, it's tough to talk about something that is not done yet, because I'm one of these people who works so slow and has so many failed projects. Yeah, I mean, I'm like the guy who literally has more, you know, wrecked models than they have completed examples. And I think that I would love to finish something in another genre. It would be a fun way to explore some other sorts of sets of concerns. But who knows if I can do it? I'm sad that way, yo.
And that was Juno Diaz speaking to us there recently in New York. This Is How You Lose Her is published by Penguin. That's all we have time for this week. If you want to listen back to or podcast the show, go to rte.ie, The Book Show, or find us on iTunes. The programme was produced by Zoe Cummins, Noel Roberts was on sound, and we'll leave you this evening with Regan Hutchins and a footnote.
What's the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning? If you're anything like the popular Victorian novelist Anthony Trollope, your manservant will wake you with coffee at 5:30. You'll sit and read over your manuscript for half an hour, reviewing yesterday's work, and then you'll set out to write 250 words every 15 minutes for 2.5 hours before you start work at the post office. Trollope, whose short life as an author began in Ireland, wrote almost 50 novels as well as plays, stories, essays and biographies. His rigorous method ensured that he wrote 10 pages of a novel every morning, and if he happened to finish a volume before his coffee was cold, he'd immediately start on the next one. Essential to this method, of course, is the manservant. You can just leave the tray down there, thank you.
The Book Show is presented by Sinead Gleeson.